Welcome to RHRealityTech.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll look at how poorly the housewife gambit worked to shut down discussion on the war on women. Arizona is getting aggressive in that war on women, conservatives keep denying, and Chris Mooney will be on to explain the science behind why conservatives just seem to be aggressively wrong about so many things. Megan Carpentier, editor at Raw Story and friend of the show, underwent a transvaginal ultrasound on video so that people could see how uncomfortable and miserable it really is.
And so if I was pregnant, you would have found it?
Mm-hmm. At this point, we would measure, depending on how far, if you were anywhere under, like 6 weeks and under, we would do the sex mean diameter, just measure a gestational sac. Any further, anywhere up to 12 weeks, we do the CRL, measure from the ground to the rump.
So how big is the gestational sac usually?
Gestational, usually I'd say probably about maybe like a centimeter or two, not really big at all.
Like so, about a size of a dime?
Really. Which, even smaller.
Okay.
Megan doesn't like the rape language some pro-choicers use to emphasize that this is vaginal penetration against a woman's will when required by the state for an abortion. But she was very clear that this was uncomfortable to the point where they didn't do the full exam because of the pain. If you were paying attention to the news a week and a half ago, you may have noticed that roughly the stupidest election year controversy imaginable happened when a liberal pundit pointed out that Ann Romney isn't a good advisor to her husband on women's economic issues because she's never worked outside the home and can't relate at all to most women's lives. This factually true statement gave Romney supporters an opportunity to take all sorts of phony umbrage on the behalf of stay-at-home mothers because the offender didn't remember to tack on the phrase outside of the home when she said Ann Romney didn't work. You know, any idiot could have told you that's what she meant. So we had to endure an epic amount of posing about how it's liberals and feminists who are really waging war on women because somebody supposedly said something mean about housewives that they didn't actually say. The Romneys position themselves as the champions of women because they narrowly support a woman's right to not work outside of the home so as to stay home and watch the children. And that anyone who suggested that staying at home to raise children wasn't the same thing as work outside of the home was a big meanie McMeanie head. Then Chris Hayes dug up this video of Mitt Romney making a speech in January.
Then while I was governor, 85% of the people on a form of welfare assistance in my state had no work requirement. And I wanted to increase the work requirement. I said, for instance, that even if you have a child 2 years of age, you need to go to work. And people said, well, that's heartless. And I said, no, I'm willing to spend more giving daycare to allow those parents to go back to work. It'll cost the state more providing that daycare, but I want the individuals to have the dignity of work.
So there you have it, right there in Romney's mouth. People who stay home to raise children instead of work outside the home don't have the dignity of work. His words, not mine. Unlike Mitt Romney, I believe that raising children is in fact work and should be treated with dignity. But enough with that. The entire thing was an elaborate farce constructed to distract from the actual issue of the war on women. Hayes talks about some of it with his program, which was about how tax codes and public assistance screw mothers over economically. Then there's the attack on something a lot of us thought, until a few years ago, was settled. Equal pay for equal work. A conservative Supreme Court made it nearly impossible for women who suffer pay discrimination to sue, and Congress passed a law rectifying that, which most Republicans didn't vote for. Here's how Romney's team replied when asked about that on a press conference about women.
The question will come from Sam Stein with Huffington Post. Please go ahead.
Yeah, does Governor Romney support the Lilly Ledbetter Act?
Sam, we'll get back to you on that.
Women should be forced to work so they can learn dignity, but their employers shouldn't be forced to pay them equally in a dignified manner. Romney is also on the record opposing the administration's policy requiring employer-based insurance to cover contraception completely, which goes a long way towards rectifying the various ways women get paid less for equal work, this time in benefits. Meanwhile, Limbaugh was spinning out of control about the evil, evil women who want to work or not or whatever. It was hard to follow. But the general idea was that feminists are wrong, patriarchy is great, and if everyone just saw that women have it so much better under restrictive gender roles, all your problems would disappear.
The last thing feminism did was really, I wouldn't say destroy, but feminism changed forever the normal human nature relationships between men and women. They forever have been altered now.
He says that like it's a bad thing. But let's review what these human nature relationships he's longing for actually were. Men legally own their wives, basically. Women weren't allowed to own property, open bank accounts, or make decisions about their own body, since men had to do that for them. Women weren't allowed to vote, and were often passed directly from father to husband like a piece of property. Men were allowed to beat and rape their wives with very little legal interference. Women were barred from working in jobs that had good pay or authority, but were forced to be support staff for those people if they wanted to work. Which is actually one thing Limbaugh singled out in his rant as a good thing, though he vaguely talked about how he missed the days when women didn't want men's jobs, that is, jobs that had good pay and real power, instead of just typing letters for people who have those jobs. Limbaugh longs for the days when women were second-class citizens legally as well as socially. But he takes the time to claim that women had it better that way.
And I always posited my belief that when it comes to freedom and opportunity in the American workplace, women have much more freedom and opportunity than men do. And always have had.
Yeah, women in his ideal world have three whole choices. You can clean up after people, type the letters of important men, or keep house and raise the children of men. Three whole choices. I don't know why women complain so much. I'd like to welcome Chris Mooney to the program. Chris is a science journalist and a best-selling author with a special interest in the intersection of science and politics. He has a new book out called The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality, which is such a great title that a guy sitting next to me on an airplane bought the book after seeing me read it and laughing at that title. Welcome to RealityCast, Chris.
Thanks for having me, and God, what an endorsement.
So much of your book, most of it really, is about the process of motivated reasoning and the role it plays in politics. Can you explain what motivated reasoning is and why it's so critical to understanding politics?
Yeah, motivated reasoning is basically reasoning that is compelled by emotions that you're not aware of. So much of politics is motivated reasoning. And what that means is that people are being struck by claims, arguments, assertions, but also, you know, maybe faces of people they disagree with. And they're having a reaction. It's super fast. You're not necessarily in control of it. And it's only then that they are, you know, starting to argue against what they disagree with and what they see as a threat. So it requires you to think about political, quote, debate in a kind of a different way. We're not all so open to all new information.
I think it's a little bit hard for people to wrap their minds around, because it seems when you kind of first initially think about it, like it just sort of makes debate useless.
That is the tough thing. It certainly makes it seem a lot different than what we assumed. What seems to be the case is that, you know, if you go into debate and you're not aware of this, then you will probably come out saying, why don't they listen to the facts? And the answer is, well, because facts aren't what are really at issue. The emotions are what are at issue. So no wonder they're not changing. It means that the context and the tone of the debate matter so much in determining whether anyone's going to be open at all.
And it seems to me that liberals especially are under this delusion that if we can just sort of present the facts in a calm and sober-minded way, we win.
Yeah, it's the legacy of the Enlightenment, and, you know, there's much to admire about the Enlightenment, but they didn't have our modern knowledge of psychology in the brain. What they had was beautiful ideals about how it should work. And it turns out that those ideals themselves seem to appeal more to the average liberal than the average conservative.
So that's one of the interesting parts of your book, and I think what makes it controversial. And I think a lot of people in the reproductive rights community are very open to your argument, because we know that while, quote, unquote, both sides are willing to embrace bad evidence if it supports their position, it really does seem that conservatives just seem to do it more. Is that true?
Certainly it's true in American politics now, and the explanation to give for why it's the case is that it's both a political phenomenon in the sense that they do this because they're threatened by certain kinds of facts or they need arguments that, in order to attack, say, reproductive rights, but also because they are psychologically, in aggregate here, not every single one of them, but the conservative movement is highly characterized by something called authoritarianism, which is a psychological personality, and that means being intolerant of ambiguity and nuance and viewing the world in black and white, thinking you're right and the other guy wrong, and there's not any gray area there. So that it's hard to see how that's not going to impact all these debates.
I found the personality stuff particularly fascinating. The way that personality tests show that there are divergences between liberal personalities and conservative personalities. Can you kind of explain in a little bit detail where there are divergences?
Mm-hmm. This is the research that ultimately convinced me that the book needed to be taken in this direction. I don't really see a way out of the argument that liberals and conservatives are different people when measured in terms of personality. There's the big five personality traits, which is one of the ways of measuring, and it's a pretty scientifically accepted one. And if you do it this way, then liberals and conservatives differ on all five, but they differ most strikingly on openness to experience and conscientiousness. And openness to experience is liberal. It's wanting to try new things, new experiences, go to new places, new restaurants, and new movies and books. And liberals always score higher than this than conservatives, or I should say liberals in aggregate score considerably higher on this than conservatives. And conscientiousness is liking order and structure and being on time and dressing neat and keeping your home neat. And conservatives tend to score much higher on that.
It seems to me that once you realize that, the debate over reproductive rights becomes so clear.
Oh, does it? Well, you have to tell me, because you've probably been living it more than me. I include reproductive rights as one of the many areas where facts are denied. But I'm not sure what you mean there.
Well, it's just funny. To me, it seems that openness to experience, having been high on that and then maybe low on conscientiousness, would explain a lot of being flexible about people's sexual choices and there being a lot of diversity there. Mm-hmm. Whereas the reverse would definitely explain this very conservative need to put everybody in the no sex before marriage, only within marriage box.
Right. But you have to combine it. I mean, these are the personalities, then there are the moralities, which are also different, and that's really important because the moralities are what push the buttons and lead to the motivated reasoning, because the moralities are deeply felt emotional themes that organize your life. And so they're also having a deep-seated emotional reactions of likely disgust towards activities that they view as impure, improper, and so forth, and that's uncontrolled and in significant part automatic.
I did think it was interesting that there's like five areas of morality, and conservatives seem to care about all five, but liberals only about what, three?
Mm-hmm. This is Jonathan Haidt's argument, and he is getting a lot of attention for it right now. And it really does all this stuff the scales fall from your eyes, and you see politics in a different way. And that his research is certainly part of that big story. Liberals focus, on equality and fairness and taking care of people in need, and that's our morality. And so we don't recognize easily that conservatives also, care about authority and care about their group and its cohesion and its success, and they care about this disgust and ensuring purity.
One thing I think is interesting in watching the media reaction to your book is that a lot of people seem to be under the impression that your thesis is that conservatives are inherently hostile to science because it's science. Is that really what you're saying, or is it more complicated than that?
Yeah, it's more complicated than that, because you could imagine a cultural or political context different than our own, in which things wouldn't play out the same way. So, you know, I'm making an argument about there's nature and then there's nurture, and we've got them combined together in such a way where we're activating this particular kind of conservatism that really is characterized by viewing the world in black and white and not tolerating different views and things like that. But, you know, you could imagine a context in which science was defined for, you know, a quote psychological conservative in such a way that it was their friend. Although, I mean, if you have a real authoritarian personality and you don't like uncertainty and you don't like nuance, then you're not going to be very inclined towards science. And so generally, the conflict is going to be between science and authoritarianism. I mean, that's the Galileo story. You know, a guy comes along, new ideas, innovation, upends what everybody thinks, and it's threatening. And so what happens? The religious authorities clamp down. I mean, that's the quintessential story of science versus authoritarianism, and I'm saying that that's normally going to be the relationship between them. But you could imagine a cultural context where, for a lot of reasons, people react differently.
Digby at Hullabaloo wrote a post where she argued that in the 1950s, so-called conservatives were actually pretty pro-science. And her argument was basically that, you know, their idea was that science was authority and that's why they supported it. It seems a little more complicated to me than that, but what's your reaction to that argument?
Well, there's some truth to it. I mean, I wish I'd seen the post, but it's certainly the case that conservatives have become more anti-science. All the data supports that. So clearly something changed, and that's you know, something that we have to explain. But to explain it, I think you have to look at the conservative movement, and you have to look at both what it did, you know, historically, and what issues it rallied over. But you also have to look at, you know, what it was psychologically, and there's a lot of evidence that it was an authoritarian movement, and this has been measured. So it's going to be both.
So one thing I want to end on, and I thought was interesting about your book, is that science denial, and specifically denial of climate change, and I don't know about other issues, but this was the one that was measured. It's not just that conservatives are likely to be climate denialists, but also that white male conservatives are the worst category of conservatives on this particular issue. Why do you think that is?
that's a tough one. I don't have a full explanation. But, you know, I think that there's some sense of, you know, when you think of white males, you think about hierarchy and being at the top of the, basically the food chain and the social structure. And, you know, when you're in this position of essentially dominance, then how do you feel towards those who challenge you? And, I think that there is a bit of that at play here. You know, I think that it's also, you know, probably, you know, white male conservatives are probably privileged in a lot of ways, including being educated. And at least for many of them, and we know that also correlates with denying the science more, because this is a motivated reasoning phenomenon, where the more you know, the more you deny, because you can come up with arguments.
That, I think, is one of the things that blows people's minds the most.
I don't know what to tell you. All the data show that, and it's repeatedly across studies. Conservatism and education leads to more denial, not less.
Well, my guest today has been Chris Mooney. His book is called The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. There's so much more to it that we don't have time to get to, so just go buy the book. It's available online and in your local bookstore, and it's on roughly every device you can read it on. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Last week, the naughty state of the week was Texas, but this week, it's time to swing that spotlight back to Arizona, which has gone bananas with the anti-choice legislation. They've now passed one of those popular bans on abortion after 20 weeks.
The House has passed a bill, 32-22, banning most abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. This will affect only a small number of abortions. It also requires our state to set up a website with images of fetuses for women to view.
Governor Jan Brewer signed it into law. There's two very important things to remember about these 20-week abortion bans. The first is that they're largely aimed at disallowing women whose fetuses have birth defects from choosing abortion, because abortions that late in pregnancy are often the result of learning something horrible from an amniocentesis. Second, and more importantly, these bans are crafted deliberately as an attack on Roe versus Wade, which disallows these kinds of bans before the third trimester. The hope is that they can, by continuing to push the date back for when women can get an abortion, make it so hard for women that reproductive rights organizations are forced to respond. And then the hope is to basically rehear Roe versus Wade with an eye towards getting it overturned. The bill also is incredibly and unusually specific about how to date when a pregnancy starts for the purposes of the ban. The Young Turks explain the problem.
Define the date of conception based on a woman's period. So it would be calculated from the first day of the last menstrual period of the pregnant woman.
Now, so there's two sides to this. Gynecologists from time to time do calculate, how many weeks you're into a pregnancy based on your menstrual cycle, and hence using that number of weeks to determine when your due date, et cetera, is not outrageous, right? It's normal. But when you use that as an excuse to push back the time period in which you can get an abortion, mm-hmm. you're in essence saying that conception happened before it actually happened.
This timing issue created a lot of controversy and confusion. But the point of bringing this up is not just that it really makes it that much harder for a doctor to do their job correctly, but because there's a very serious problem in trying to make law what is custom. The reason doctors do it this way is because it works best for their purpose, which is getting a woman proper medical care and charting her pregnancy. But when you make that kind of thing law, it has a whole lot more ramifications. Saying that women can legally be pregnant 2 weeks before they conceive is a ripe opportunity for anti-choice mischief, which the Young Turks pointed out succinctly.
You know, doctors have disagreement or are unclear as to when to determine when a woman is got pregnant, right? Mm-hmm. It's difficult to pinpoint that exact day. Mm-hmm. So if doctors who have medical training can't pinpoint that day, who are lawmakers to make that decision for them?
The important thing to remember here is anti-choice legislators in Arizona should be assumed to have the worst intentions at all points in time. After all, they have a long history of writing already bad bills that, when you examine them closely, contain a poison pill, making them even more toxic.
However, the new Arizona birth control bill, House Bill 2625, states that women who want their birth control to be covered by their insurance plans must verify its purpose to be solely for medical reasons and not to prevent pregnancy. The bill would allow employers to deny female employees the right to be covered based on religious beliefs.
The bill went down when opponents pointed out that the bill not only gave employers right to deny coverage, but also to fire employees who are using contraception to have sex. After all, if you apply for coverage and your employer is allowed to peruse your medical records and ask about your sex life, they now have that info about you. And since Arizona is in an at-will employment state, they can fire you for it. So it's wise at this point to assume that the worst interpretation of any conservative bill in Arizona is the accurate one.
When I get down, you know I get down. When I get around, you know I get around. When I get down.
And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, talking about what really matters edition. Fox's Todd Starnes called into the Jeff Katz show to discuss why they don't think much of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, amongst other things.
And this smells like something Debbie Wasserman Schultz would cook up. Could you imagine her as your Hooters waitress? Hello, my name is Debbie.
The whole segment was disgusting. In short order, we learned that in order to be an acceptable woman, one must oppose abortion rights, love Hooters, look like someone who could work at Hooters, and, you know, being a housewife doesn't hurt. The contradictions are immense, starting with the whole belief that women should greet you tits out, but a woman who actually has sex deserves government punishment.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.